Hey, what's going on? This is Brandon.
This is Joshua.
Hey, this is Dave.
And this is Rick Dugdale, director of Zero Contact. And you're now tuned in to PBD Horror.
And you're now tuned in to PBD Horror.
Pretty. All of you are very pretty.
Please don't.
I love you.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening or watching whatever one you are doing. We are joined here today with Rick Dugdale, filmmaker of the film Zero Contact and many other projects which you've produced. So, Rick, thanks for joining us, man.
Hey, man. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So first off, I just want to say congratulations on getting this film made. And even like now kind of stepping into the next phases of this project, which we can talk about a little bit later. I'm just curious if you could talk to us a little bit about what this project has meant to you. And now that you're here with like the, you know, the first one about to be released, how are you feeling now?
Yeah, I mean, it's been, it was an ambitious project from the get-go, you know. It's like during the pandemic, well, the beginning of the pandemic, we kind of all came together and said, well, how can you make a film if we have all these restrictions? Like, you know, you can't leave your house. And so we started to workshop this idea really quickly and came up with this idea of just how to pull this off. And then I kind of fell into directing it because it was Cam and I had kind of come up with the concept and we were planning to kind of war room it where you'd have a monitor here, so Japan and Germany. And it was like, well, who's going to run the war room? And someone needs to talk to the actors. And so I kind of fell into directing it like that. But, you know, I planned to direct at some point in my career. This wasn't exactly the way I was going to launch my career, but sure. Here we are.
You kind of got thrown into it then.
Yeah. I fell into my own crazy idea. It's probably the best way to put it. It's like someone has to take the reins of this, you know, experimental thing that is this going to work or not. And so to drive the ship, you know, I suppose it had to be me. No one else is crazy enough.
It came together, that's for sure. So kudos to you, man.
Hey, thanks. You know, it was, we just didn't want to make a Zoom movie. We didn't want to make it about COVID, and it better not be a horror movie because everyone else is probably making a horror movie about COVID on Zoom right now. So we kind of came at it from, let's try to avoid all of that and separate ourselves. And it had to be international. That was the other factor. It was our Hallmark formula that wasn't for Hallmark, you know?
Yeah.
Yes, international is the ticket, you know, for us.
Yeah.
So I'm going to throw a question out of left field here. I saw that you had worked on X-Files, and I'm just really curious because that was pretty groundbreaking stuff, X-Files. What exactly did you get to do on the set?
You know, so that's actually funny because, you know, all through high school, I kind of was in film school in high school. Our program, our high school had a film program. That's kind of how I got into it, aside from child acting. But I was a fan of X-Files in the early 90s, like from the very beginning of X-Files. Cut to getting out of high school and my first job, real job in the film business, I was a PA on X-Files. And so all of a sudden it was like, whoa, man, this is the shit I like anyways. And then you're working on, I actually got to work on all the Chris Carter shows. I did Millennium. I did Harsh Realm. I did Lone Gunman briefly as a scout. So I came up in the location ranks and kind of cut my teeth there. And, you know, I realized that, you know, growing up in Canada there, if you're a PA, you're in the DGC, the Directors Guild. If you're a PA in America, you will work your way into the Teamsters as a locations department. But, you know, 95% of the people, when they hit the fork in the road in Canada, do you become an AD or do you become a location manager? And so I always like to say the smart ones realize you're closer to producing if you go the locations path, because I was 22, 23, and I'd have $6 or $7 million in my department for the locations department, which now we know we can make 7 or 8 movies for that price. So, but starting on X-Files was incredible and also a big show of that time, you know?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. So, you know, looking at your credits as producer, prior to this film, like you had already worked with Anthony Hopkins, which we also kind of learned about from talking to one of the co-stars in Zero Contact, Alex, because he was also in that film. Yeah. So you'd already worked with him, and then you worked with some other big names, such as like Ben Kingsley, which is a huge name, obviously. So these are like acting legends.
Yeah.
So what is it? What was it like working with them, and kind of like, what was your takeaways from working with these people who are so veteran in the field and, you know, these are so good at their craft?
I mean, the takeaways are, you know, they get the term legends for a reason. You know, like their process is the biggest thing you can see is, you know, like working with Anthony Hopkins on Blackway, getting to know him and seeing how his process was on that as a producer, I had that knowledge that I witnessed, right? So going into this film, it was a matter of A, convincing him that the film we're about to do from your sofa is actually going to find a life, and it's actually going to work if your character, you know, if you execute what I know you can. So having the background with him and the history, it made the sales pitch to say, here's how we're going to shoot a film from your couch, you know? Guys like with like Ben Kingsley, they all function the same way. And that is, I mean, I shouldn't say function the same way, but their process of getting a deeper dive into the character, creating a backstory. I think if some of these actors were allowed to expand on the role that they created, there would be six prequels to the films that they do. There would be, you know, so much that there's so... And it may not be accurate to what the writer wants them to portray, but it's a backstory that actors create to help them portray what's on the page, you know? And so that was the big takeaway from both of them, is that they had a way down the rabbit hole. Well, Finley Hart did this, and I think he was in Bohemian Grove getting high on acid. And it's like, well, that's not really what was in the script.
Yeah.
But that sequence that you're referring to, doing acid and going to Bohemian Grove, is... won't show up in the film necessarily, but that's where he paints the picture. And it's like, wow, that's sure. The interpretation.
Yeah.
But these guys are amazing, you know, they're, yeah, for a reason.
Yeah. They're creating like their own backstories and just they're kind of like paving a storyline for them to kind of be able to interpret into how they perform it.
Yeah.
Something that was like really interesting and cool though, is like even the actors of Zero Contact. So Chris, we met with Chris Brochu already and Alex Ponovic, I think is how you say his last name. They both have very different ways that they enter their roles, but it was interesting hearing them describe, because Chris was more like he tries to find something inside of him that connects to the character. And I just found he's got a very like philosophical and approach to things. And then Alex is like, I want to actually try to experience what I think that person is going to go through. And he told us a story about this film that he did where he actually was stuffing ice in his shoes because his character was supposed to be freezing, and that sounded terrible. But for him, he wants to go to that extreme.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's called method, I think. If you're playing a serial killer, just don't hang out with him before the film.
Yeah, stay away.
I think, but that's the way that you just described it is actually the way they do function, you know? And it's like, I got to work with them. This is my third film with Chris and my second film with Alex, technically 20 years ago. Him and I did a film in 2001 together, Alex and I. But yeah, I mean, they definitely have a different approach. And there's definitely a you know, there's a, especially the way we made the film, there was a level of insecurity of like, and you know, I knew deep down, it's like, they're probably thinking, is this thing going to work? What are we doing here? It's a good thing I have time right now, Rick, because I'm not making a movie because this damn COVID thing's going on.
Yeah.
Right? But there's certainly a layer of, they needed to have the faith and the trust in like what we were doing. And we were no experts because no one's done a film this way, right? So it wasn't like we were coming at it from like, we know everything. But the one thing we wanted to do was kind of create the professionalism of a real set. And so we felt if we could do that by having the DP on the line and the AD and the editor and the production designer, that it would put them in a place where it's like, if you hear the AD go, okay, guys, pictures up, let's get ready, people in their positions. If they hear that, these actors will go, okay, I'm not in control. I'm on a film set, you know? And that I think worked. And once they realized, because if we were doing the movie like this, it's like, you know, okay, guys, you know, you know, Dave, you shoot your sequence. That's truly a Zoom movie, right? Yeah. And we used Zoom to stand on set. We didn't use Zoom to shoot the film, right? Mm-hmm. And so there were times when Chris Brochu and Alex, but their performances, you could see our team kind of going like this, really tight, going, this is going to work, you know? And you could see like Chris's performance, like these guys are professional and they went for it. And I think the psychology of feeling like they're standing on a set when they went for it and we were getting emotional with his performance, that's when I knew this is actually going to work.
Yeah.
And then you'd relay that to Alex and Alex does the same thing. And it's like, people were just like going for it. And you look at Rukia Bernard, the scene where she's being captured, that was terrifying. Like, and that's, you know, it's in the trailer, but when you see that performance, like they were going for it, you know, and you know, we got lucky. We had great actors that yeah. bought in, you know, to the whole process.
Absolutely.
Was it really hard to like, so the secret was out that everyone had their own set and no one actually acted off of each other. They all did everything independently, which you can't even tell when you watch a movie. That's like a testament. Was it really hard to direct when the actors had to set everything up in their house and do the lighting and the basically all their own stuff and not have anybody to act off of?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, you definitely need to cast the right actors because some actors, like, what do you mean? Hair and makeup's not coming to my house. But what do you mean? You know, or where's my trailer? Well, it's actually down the corridor in your own apartment. So if you need a break, but you know, there was a lot of times where, you know, like for example, the chemistry, you know, it's like we, at one point we're going to do a Zoom like this where they would act opposite each other on a Zoom, but we weren't capturing it on Zoom. So you'd have a technical delays or sound glitch, or it would be out of sync because your camera is either A, up behind you, the security camera, or is mounted right over here and we teach them how to mount it. So we couldn't have them on the Zooms reading opposite. So we separated them entirely, which means they never met. I think we did one table read. And then what I was hoping for is the lack of chemistry and the lack of connection is exactly how we as humans have lived our lives the last 2 years. And that lack of human connection would come through in the film because they didn't have that chemistry and comfort and that sure. slight disconnect. And I think it worked, you know, I think that's and great editor brought that together.
Yeah,
it did work. So that's really cool.
Yeah.
So I want to go back to something you had said. You did like location management, and I'm just yeah. really curious, like how is it working in location management? And you did some location managements for some big stuff, like I think Smallville and like Catwoman. Yeah. And that's big stuff. And I'm really curious, like what that entails and how you can really work, like finding and working in locations like that. Hey, you know,
I love the job and I still love and respect what location managers do because you're front facing. You're literally the public figure representing Warner Brothers, right? You're the first person Warner Brothers wants to shoot in your house. The first point of contact is the location manager, maybe the scout actually, right? And I did a lot of scouting. But when you look at it, it's like, I look back and it's really producing an event. You're an event planner. You're producing, like I look at a house and go, okay, here's this house. If it aesthetically like works for the director, then they're going to come scout and they're going to say, great, this works. Let's bring in the 10 technicians to check it out. Okay, good for them. All right, let's bring in the 300 crew. Let's take over the neighborhood. Let's remove those power lines across the street because we need to get a camera crane in here. That all starts with the location manager, scout, right? And that I always found fascinating because now you look back, at you're producing a movie. You're taking a script. You're adding a director, you're bringing in a bunch of key personnel, you're bringing in financing and distribution, and then you go make the movie and distribute it. That's how I looked at it, you know, and people, I look back at that, because when you're going through that process, you're like, I'd rather be an AD and just run into the trailers and getting the actors to set, thinking that's the glam job. But that's also can be a road to nowhere. But I always felt the smart people would know location managing was the pathway to producing movies.
Sure. So let me ask you a question, kind of going off this a little bit. So earlier you had said, you know, at some point you knew you wanted to direct a film, you just weren't sure it was going to be this. You've done a lot of stuff with producing, location management. What actually got you into filmmaking? Like, why did you get into filmmaking? What was kind of your first intention with it?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, because you guys are from Providence, I'm sure you got to be hockey fans. I grew up really as a hockey player, and okay. You know, was born with a hockey stick. And I was actually in a pretty tragic car accident when I was 7 years old that I couldn't continue playing hockey. So they allowed me to play hockey for 3 more years. And then I couldn't, through my draft years, you know, your junior draft years, like 14 to play junior, wasn't going to happen. And so growing up in a small town, like, what are your outlets? And the local bowling team wasn't overly exciting. And so I got into theater, and I started doing, you know, acting at that point. And then was in all the short films high school, and being a more of a creative outlet than a physical outlet. Now, cut to 20 some years later, I'm now playing hockey in LA, which makes total sense. But, that was kind of my pivot, I think, in my path to get into actual film production. And so I went from my small town to Vancouver to LA almost, you know, consecutively. And here we are.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, quite an interesting path. And so when you first got into film, were you hoping to go more into the acting part rather than more of like the technical aspects of it?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, it's funny you bring this up. I mean, there was another pivot in my life. You know, I was an actor basically from, let's say, 91 to, 2000. I lost my father. And in 2000, I couldn't deliver an emotion without going one direction.
Sure.
So I didn't feel confident acting really after since the day he died. And I'd already been in physical production for a few years at that point, kind of doing acting auditions while doing location work on X-Files. And so when that happened, I'm like, that's my time to just focus on, you know, where my strengths lie, which is probably behind the camera. And that was kind of the second pivot, I guess. Now the pandemic, maybe the third pivot.
It's super interesting how, you know, and I think this is true for most people, but like we have these really like impactful moments in life that almost bring us to like what we're supposed to become, or where we're like it changes our direction completely. And like maybe we didn't foresee that, but then suddenly it's like, oh yeah, all right, that makes total sense. And, you know, had you not had those at the time very difficult moments, you wouldn't be creating this film and working with, you know, Anthony Hopkins and, you know,
totally doing true.
Publicity tours and stuff like that. Yeah. So
I've never looked at it that way of like those changes in your life that changes the trajectory, but that's exactly what took place, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and Dave's a psychologist. I don't know if you could tell.
Again?
I said, Dave's a psychologist. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm like, wait, is this for sure?
He does it to me all the time. And I'm starting talking. I'm like, Dave, you're using your psychology on me, knock it off.
Right. Exactly.
I do find it interesting because some people in those moments, they kind of freeze and they don't know how to move forward. But then some people actually end up finding a whole different path. And then it turns out into these good experiences, which kind of things.
I find use it as motivation. Like I've always taken tragedy for motivation and inspiration. Like, you know, nothing really gets you down. And that's kind of how I try to live my life, you know? And so it's like, boom, pandemic hits. Oh, woe is me. What can we do? All right, let's do it this way. And let's ideate around this. And great, let's do an NFT release and let's do this, you know? Every door that shuts, many more open, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. At a time where everybody was kind of panicking, like, how am I going to work? How am I going to, you were like, all right, well, we're going to figure this out one way or another. Yeah. And had you not had those life experiences, maybe you wouldn't have been thinking that way. So that's pretty cool.
Spoken like a good psychologist, indeed.
So, all right. So in another direction, adding Anthony Hopkins to any project is obviously a major upgrade to your project. And it's so funny. I have two questions about Anthony Hopkins' involvement in this film. The first is, like, what would you have done or did you have like a list of people that you were hoping to get and like it just, oh, Anthony's going to do it. All right, great. Or was it like, I want Anthony or I'm, you know, we're just going to go with a, you know, a lesser known actor.
So this is hysterical because we have, you know, 20 or 30 films going at one point, like development, and we're casting movies left, right, and center. You never get your first choice. You're like 10 deep on, and then it's the whole thing of, no, you're our first choice, right? That happens, right? But yeah. But with Anthony Hopkins, he was the guy and we went out and got him. And that was it, you know, and it took again, it's because I had a relationship with him. I could walk him through the process, right, and convince him that it wouldn't be a waste of your time. You're not going to embarrass yourself or anyone else. And, you know, having that, you know, he became a friend, his family's lovely. And they, I also knew them. So that helped the process for sure. But he was the guy. He was the guy that we went to get for sure.
Something tells me, like, does he really know he's in this film? Because I don't even think he was acting. I feel like you were literally just taping a conversation you were having with him. He was so like just natural. The way that he delivers lines, it's like, he's just, it's like a real conversation.
Well, you know, again, it's like the work he put into the character just brought him to life, you know? And I think I'm no expert in it, certainly a first time director. Even my experiences, you know, my body work as a producer, like he brought that character to life. And I've heard that. All these other filmmakers talk about that. I brought it up. I see what they mean. You know, He would, and you only, you know, if you meet him, he'll say, call me Tony. He doesn't want to be called Anthony. He doesn't want to be called Sir Tony. It's Tony, right? He's the most humble, modest legend to ever walk the earth, you know, but he would call in the middle of the night. He would send long, long emails about his character and complexities. And what if we change this? And that would be, like, and he did that on Blackway too, just these long, and I wasn't even directing that movie, but I would still get the emails. And like, I'm talking by the dozens, you know? So, and it's because of how much of a deep dive he's going into and is like exploring this. It's like I can imagine it's like an outer body experience for him. But what he brought to these characters is like on both films, it's just incredible, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I just, it would have been interesting had the film not had Anthony Hopkins, if what that experience would have been like watching it. He just adds something that it's like.
The gravitas. It's the gravitas. He is Finley Hart. You know, he is He is the guy. And as we expand the universe and go into part two and three, it's like being able to explore where he's going to go with that is super cool, you know.
So I'm going to save you the trouble of giving us the synopsis of the film because we've already had Chris and Alex give it already. So, your interview is going to come after theirs, just in the order that we've done them. Yeah. But I do want to just kind of talk about, you know, this film has some really like, a lot of different, like, elevated concepts, I guess you would say, and a lot of elevated verbiage that, you know, wouldn't be just common language that we would be throwing around. And how much research went into kind of creating this world, this, like, the ideas they're throwing out there? We're talking about like quantum physics and time travel, and like, just it's a lot. So like, how hard was that to develop?
Well, the thing is, like, we knew when we were shooting, and there were subsequent drafts coming as we were shooting. That's kind of when we knew that we're going to make part two and three, right? And where to expand that, and where to expand it outside of a, let's call it a remote movie, you know? And that is like, imagine if there was no science fiction, but there was science, right? And imagine if this universe that we were building, and Finley Hart, this isn't science fiction, and he's used science and quantum physics to really solve the problems of time travel, interstellar travel, using the Earth's electrical grid points like the ancient astronauts supposedly did, right? That is the line that we are walking, right? That is it, the Chariots of the Gods, Eric Van Daniken's book, and, you know, his theory, or is it you know, science versus science fiction? And also, if you look at Finley Hart, anybody who would have the power to harness that power of creating interstellar travel, what if the person who actually could do that. It wasn't about that. And it was really about lost loved ones and connection. And that is really what we're building, right? Finley Hart's character, he could just be Elon Musk or Richard Branson in time travel and interstellar travel. That's science fiction. But if he's using the science to connect the dots of lost loved ones, yeah, that's really a love story using science that puts us into a futurist kind of scenario.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. So without giving away too much, can you go in and tell us what's going to happen in 2 and 3? I mean, you don't have to give away a lot, but I'm
afterwards. Yeah, no, I can. I mean, look, it's out there a little bit. I mean, the thing is that we shot this film remotely, and we did zero contact in 17 countries, 89 cast and crew all remotely. This is a continuation of innovation. So we're making the film conventionally, but unconventionally, that we started filming in Antarctica as the first film in history to film in Antarctica. And then you ask yourself, why did they shoot there and not shoot in Winnipeg or Montana, like every other filmmaker does to replicate Antarctica? But then when you go there and you go, ah, I see. Yeah, there's no trees here.
Yeah.
Right. Because no one's ever done it. Therefore, you can do the research you want, but go watch The Thing. I think it opens with helicopters flying in over trees. Guess what? There are no trees there. Spoiler alert. So part of the whole thing is that we want to take our audience to these places that no one really travels to. So we're going to Jordan, to Wadi Rum. We're going to Petra, to Egypt, and we're going to the Giza Plateau and, you know, Puma Punku in Bolivia. And all these things, yes, tied to the maybe Earth's electrical grid points, Micronesia, and all these places. Because if you put the work in as a production, as producers, it's not that complicated. Don't be lazy. Just take your production there and shoot it. And then you're going to increase your production value. And that makes life interesting, and that makes a better film. So that's where we're going with it. And it's partially Indiana Jones with the sophistication of Inception, not to create a bar that we can't reach.
Sure.
But that's really the where we're going with the concept.
Dude, I know you're
your cast. Indiana Jones. I love that. I love that. Just go there. Just go there. Just go there and do it.
Antarctica? Well, wait, how do we get there? We take a flight? No, you can't take the next flight to Antarctica. It takes logistics, but that's what producing really is, right? It's logistics, personality management. Yeah. So,
and you're the first ones to film there, right?
First scripted film in history, we've been told by the Antarctica Treaty Program to ever do that. So we slated in Antarctica, which was also my first scene for real directing. So it was a couple firsts there, but what an amazing experience. You know, that was, you know, there's 15 people that went because we knew specifically. Jim Cameron tried to do it years ago, but he wanted 85 people to go. And they said, hey man, it's for scientists only. We don't care about filmmakers. We'll give you 15. And he's like, 15. That's probably his personal entourage is 15. But I knew that number. And so through some connections and some polar explorers, we knew that we could get in with 15 people, and everybody needed to know how to grow a potato on Mars was kind of the theory. And but of the 15 people, 13 people first step on the ice broke down in tears. You know, there, wow, there was something cool going on there. And the other two guys have done Everest like 10 times. So they're hard as rock.
They weren't fazed. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that, like, all right. So like you're in Antarctica. What did you see? I mean, you got to describe this just briefly for us, because that sounds like an amazing experience.
Tons of polar bears.
Yes. We were
terrified. But no, zero polar bears.
Oh, damn.
That's the North Pole. There's penguins there. But it was, you know, it got up to minus 60 degrees, 130, 140 mile an hour winds. We, in hindsight, we looked at it the first 4 days we were there. Beautiful, meaning sunny 24 hours a day. Not talking daylight. Like, we're talking direct sunlight 24 hours a day. But it was super cold, you know, but we were also trained. We had a whole lead up to it. Expedition experts telling us the 4-layer system. So you'd never go below 2 layers. It's crazy. And I never saw my feet for 6 days. Has that ever happened to you in your life? Your belly button. I didn't see my belly button for 7 days, you know? And it was crazy, you know, but it was an experience. Like when we shot the sequences with the actors and we had a real deep emotional conversation because we're shooting the end of part two there. And it's a pretty emotional sequence, an ethereal sequence. And it didn't take much for the actors to get into a place, but that's a performance and an emotion. You don't replicate that on a green screen.
Right.
And it was a pretty cool experience. But that feeling is what we want to go and get in all these locations, you know, and we hope to do.
I wonder, did the actors had no idea that this was the direction things were going to go when you first got them on board, right?
No, no. They thought, okay, yeah, Rick's calling, another crazy idea. All right, I'm not doing anything. This damn pandemic's going to go another week. So, all right, let's fine, let's do it. And then when we got into it and I was like, we got into post-production and the post team was like, well, wait a second. This is really good. We need more time to do what's necessary versus just rushing it out the door like we intended to do. And then when we got it to a place to screen, and we were super secretive with the screenings, like in today's world, you send a Vimeo with a password, but for this one it was super secretive because we knew there was other people out there trying to do stuff like it. But then I showed it to the actors and they were like, oh my God, this actually works. And I'm like, brought everybody together. Guess what? We're going to do a sequel and we're not doing two. We're doing two and three because it was critical to tell the world we're doing two and three because you want to shine the light on it being a franchise.
Sure.
Every producer makes a sequel. We all want to make sequels. But if you say three is going at the same time, then it, you know, it's, it becomes obvious that it's something bigger than a two-parter kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And then when I did tell them, I said, and we're going to go to Antarctica and we're going to go here and you're going to get a car and you're going to get, no, but it was, you know, everyone, I think who's gotten to know me is like, all right, this guy, like if he says we're going to shoot on Mars, we probably are going to shoot on Mars somehow.
He's going to make it happen somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. So well, that's kind of
been. If anyone knows how to do it, it's you. You know how to make that happen. So
that's kind of it. And we'll see where part three ends. But I think, you know, Antarctica I knew was possible. And so when I said that, like I knew we could pull it off, but you talk about logistics. I mean, that's serious producing right there for sure. Anything could have gone wrong. Zero insurance for equipment, for date scheduling issues, you know? So,
yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is kind of a loaded question I have for you. But I like to ask when we get filmmakers on here, I just like to ask them to offer tips to future filmmakers on how to make their visions become a reality and like what you've learned about this whole process or maybe even like kind of throughout your career and what advice you would offer to someone who's interested in making their own film.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm a big proponent of, you know, doing what we can to help filmmakers, you know, start out. And I think, you know, don't go by the handbook, you know, look around at your surroundings and see what you have available and make a film with the inventory of your life, you know, and if that's a certain amount of equipment, but people get too caught up in how rigid filmmaking needs to be. You need to tell a story, right? It starts with a story. That's how you engage an audience. That's how you get cast. That's how you get distribution. I think the other thing is in today's world is that you've got to make a story that is international. We all know that if you grow up in Idaho, I use Idaho way too much because someone's going to pitch me the Idaho dairy farming script and I'll say, great, I talk poorly about it all the time. But the thing is, if you write a movie like contained thriller, I hate hearing that too, because let the producers, let us figure out how to make it not contained. Contained's not necessarily a good thing, right? If you're making a horror movie, you guys must be fans, but if you make a horror movie and if you're writing it and you're starting out to direct your first movie, and you can tell what the trailer is going to look like. And if it's like, you know, a guy driving down an RV and the RV flips over and Jason climbs out, or the cabin in the woods, the people running and being chased by something. If that's what you think a trailer looks like in your artwork, the distributor is going to think the same thing. And they're going to go, we've seen this 1,000 times. And it's going to limit your roads to victory to get your film with distribution. So what I say is you can make a version of that, but make it international. You know, you can do a small contained term, if you have to use that, contained film. If it's like two actors that go to Italy on vacation and they get kidnapped and they end up in Bucharest and it's a mini Taken, and then they escape into Moldova, go to Moldova. We haven't seen Moldova on screen. It's not that difficult to get there, and take your small crew with you. Then they escape out of Moldova. They get to Stockholm. They take the boat across to the UK and make their way back to Idaho. Right? Now you have an international contained thriller with a small cast and crew. But guess who's going to want to buy the movie and distribute it? A lot of people, because it ticks the box in multiple countries. You've opened your film up. You've taken an audience to places they don't go. It's international. And you have an international cast. That's how you launch your career. Don't be scared. That can still be done for the right budget. You know,
sure.
Don't read the handbook. There's other ways to make movies.
I love that. Like what you're saying, it goes along with a lot of like similar in the vein of like just stop listening to everybody else all the time. Yeah. When we talk to filmmakers, it's always about that. It's always like you can do things your way. You don't always have to like follow this clear path that people are directing.
I always say that, you know, we're in the business of making movies, not talking about making movies.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that talk about it, you know. So just like find the script, find the story, go make it, you know. Of course, it's not easy. You need financing and stuff like that, but you can also innovate. You know, I think there's a future where a film like Zero Contact, there's a version like that non-pandemic, you know, but open it up more. If I had one regret in the film, it's that we didn't shoot in more countries, because it would have been possible, you know, and get more wide exteriors of, Azerbaijan, or how do you say that actually, just remote locations that could have opened it up a little more, you know, that's possible.
Absolutely. That's really cool. So we're running short on time, but before we go, can you tell us about the ETFs? I'm not even clear what that is. And I know there's one for the film, and I'm super curious about it.
So assuming you mean NFTs.
Yeah, he did. Yes.
So that's you didn't know much about it. I was like, okay, so.
I don't know anything about NFTs at all. And I find it fascinating that there's one for the film. And I was like, now I have to know.
So here's what it is that I believe it's the future. A future component to film distribution. It's a revenue stream for distributors that was never there before and for rights holders. But what it is like Web3, right? It's the blockchain and the future of the internet and Web3. It's about creating a fan base and a community that is there to support you primarily, right? It's a different psychology than your Netflix subscription. People still want to own stuff. You have DVDs. I think they're DVDs, not books, but like you have a DVD collection. Imagine if you have a digital version of those, and I'm not talking to download on Apple TV, right? You have the NFT. There's only so many. In our case, there's 27,511 available worldwide forever in perpetuity. So when those sell out, you have to get it on the secondary market. But when you have it, you are part of something. It's the Metallica t-shirt from the concert. But the t-shirt, if you have the t-shirt, it gets you a ticket to the next concert. But then, you know, you have utility items within that community, and you build this on Discord, which Discord is like the Facebook for the NFT space and crypto and blockchain. But it's really about creating a positive environment in a community and being able to listen to the community that has supported you and your project. And it gives us the ability to then, make a sequel, make a TV series, add more components and utility. You want access to the set, come to the set. The first 11 copies of this film were sold on on OpenSea. And the utility that's included in there, you get to shoot yourself into the film. So you can play Omar or Rebecca or Rachel, whoever you want. And your version of the film is you with Anthony Hopkins, right? That you don't get to do on a James Bond movie. But the future is going to exist where you can do that, right? So that's like fan engagement. It maybe will help with, you know, positive reviews, because in a Facebook group, people can troll and talk shit all the time. But this is like, why would you devalue something that you're part of? You know, you're not going to, it's an expression I shouldn't say right now, but you know what I mean? There's a version of this where it's like, it prevents negativity. And that's really what Web3 is all about. You know, you have Rotten Tomatoes, bad reviews. Why would you write a bad review if you own the house? You know, you don't want to devalue your house. Right. And it makes people be a little more respectful and responsible. And, you know, it's the utopian, harmonious version of where film distribution can go. But it's a scarcity component. It's exclusive access. You're part of a community that when you leave the Marvel theater, you bought the popcorn, you leave, you now are detached from Marvel and they're detached from you. This is a way for people to live together and build something. So world building is really what NFTs, where they can, where it's going to go.
Interesting.
Well, thank you for the education there, because I have no idea. That's pretty cool. We'll have to hit you up for the link to that also.
Okay. Yeah, cool. The metaverse. We'll save that for the next podcast and
okay.
talk about the metaverse.
Oh, man. You know, this has been a really enjoyable set of interviews for us. We've learned a ton. And just like each of these interviews, as much as they talked about filmmaking and movies, they've also been a little bit about life and decision making and a ton of other stuff. So we really appreciate, you know, yourself, Chris, and Alex joining us for this week of promotion for the film. And we appreciate you guys letting us check it out and kind of do our part to help with the process as well.
Yeah. Awesome, guys. Well, hey, it's been great and fun talking to you guys too, you know, so I really enjoyed it and happy to do it again when the next time presents itself.
Before you go, can you tell our listeners where to find you? And then just again, tell them for the third time that they've already heard it, when this movie's released and where they'll be able to find it.
Yeah. So I'm on Instagram as Rick Dugdale, on Twitter as Rick Dugdale, and Facebook. There's Enderby Entertainment. You can follow along. You know, that's a resource to help filmmakers as well. We're always there to be a voice and offer some opinions to help filmmakers as well. Viewly's on Discord under Viewly Digital. And the film comes out on Friday with Lionsgate. It's going to be theatrical parts of the country, video on demand. And if you're not going to see Top Gun, please check out Zero Contact as counter programming.
It's a great promotion right there. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks, and guys. We hope you enjoy the film. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Game over.